Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know started to burn too many things we found. That's the great Darwayan singer Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the lyrics to that song, except for one, the word Solartopia, which I wrote, amazingly enough. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. We're back for another hour here, the Green Power and Wellness Show at PRN, Progressive Radio Network. I want to thank the crew in New York for doing it this week, and we're going to talk about nukes. We started about talk about nukes last week, but we were interrupted by the great Craig Unger and his breathtaking House of Trump, House of Putin, exposing the deep ties of Donald Trump to the Russian mafia. It is not anti-Russian to point out that Donald Trump grew up in a mafia family and is today owned and operated by the newest Don Corleone, Don Putin, the master of the Russian mob. He owns Donald Trump lock, stock, and barrel. If you want to hear that, go to the archive, listen to last week's show with Craig Unger, author of House of Trump, House of Putin, which I highly recommend. And we were joined in that show last week by Linda Seeley, who stopped breathing. Linda, are you still alive?
I started breathing again.
Oh, thank goodness. And then you came down to Los Angeles and were a participant in our Great Left Coast Forum. And Kevin Camps, you were on with us. Kevin, have you had cement shoes yet? Or are you still with us?
I'm here. Mm-hmm.
Great. All right. And Donna Gilmore talking to us from San Diego. Donna, you with us?
Yes, I'm in actually in Orange County, 5 miles from San Onofre as the crow flies.
Well, thank God San Onofre is shut. We have a few small details to deal with alongside that, but we'll get to them. Kevin, you raised in the show last week with Craig Unger the realities of the Chernobyl nuclear plant, the four reactors there, one of which, of course, exploded and sent radiation all over the world, not in quantities not exceeded until Fukushima happened in 2011. Chernobyl blew up in 1986. But the reality is that the sarcophagus going over the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And we talked about this a bit last week, so I wanted to pick up on it. A multi-billion dollar project, the biggest movable structure on Earth. Is there any indication that the mob has been involved in the building of this thing, and when can we expect it to sort of implode and fall over?
Well, I don't know that we, you know, have documentation that the Russian or Ukrainian mob was a part of the project, but as in the United States, the mob, the mafia, gangsters are often involved in large construction projects because there's so much money involved. You know, and there's even a history of Donald Trump being involved with the mafia in this country on concrete jobs, like up in New York and Atlantic City. So, you know, there's a very good chance that the same is true at the Chernobyl new replacement sarcophagus. I think the design life, as you said, it cost probably a couple billion dollars to build that thing. It took a very long time. There were long work stoppages because it was an international effort and countries wouldn't fork up the dough, even though they lived downwind of it in Europe many times. And the danger was that the old sarcophagus that was hastily built in the aftermath of the disaster at huge human cost to the workers was, you know, on the brink of collapsing and could have sent another radioactive cloud over Europe. So they finally got the thing done a couple years ago and moved it into place. And I believe it has a design life of 100 years, which is what makes this all so preposterous. So in 100 years, we get to do it all over again.
God, it's insane. So on this show, we're gonna talk about things like this. We're going to have an overview of where we are with nuclear power because we have to keep continuing tabs on it. And Donna is going to give us a primer on nuclear waste and where we stand with that, with the high-level radioactive waste at San Onofre being just 100 feet from the timeline. It's just unbelievable. But let's talk about Chernobyl a bit more and the involvement of organized crime. In the nuclear power industry, I'm reminded, of course, the whole nuclear power industry is organized crime, but that's another story. I'm reminded of what happened at Zimmer in Ohio in the 1970s and 80s. There was the company building it had heard all these rumors, and they hired a private investigator named Tom Applegate to go in and look at what was going on the Zimmer site, which is at Moscow, Ohio, not far from Cincinnati on the Ohio River. And Tom Applegate came back with reports that rebar steel that was supposed to be going into reinforcing the containment dome was being taken by the workers and turned into belt buckles on site. They had built a factory for turning rebar steel into belt buckles. He said there was also, of course, a major drug ring, which you would expect, and also prostitution going on at the site, and that a lot of parts and components of the nuke were just kind of disappearing. And then Applegate made his report to Cincinnati Gas and Electric, which was the primary builder of this thing, and CG&E told him that they accepted his report, and then they ordered him to not make any public disclosures, which he proceeded to do, and they really nailed him. And none of Tom Applegate's findings were published in any newspapers in Ohio. He couldn't get any Ohio paper to publish what he'd found, and finally had it published in the Chicago Tribune. So I'm sure that kind of stuff is just the tip of the iceberg of what goes on at a nuclear site. Linda Seeley and San Luis Obispo, did we have anything like that at Diablo Canyon?
Not that we know of, no. During the construction, they had a lot of trouble with it. But right now, PG&E, they got a very good report from the NRC last year, and they seem to be really minding their P's and Q's right now. So,
okay. Well, of course, if you tried to take the rebar steel now and made a belt buckle, you'd certainly have a lethal weapon. Donna Gilmore, what kind of stuff did we hear at San Onofre and at other and the dealing with nuclear waste? Any involvement of organized crime that you know of?
I guess you could call the nuclear industry kind of an organized crime situation, at least the way it seems to be working here at San Onofre, where you have companies that are all covering for each other and doing things to make money, but not to protect our safety. We had a recent situation where a whistleblower came forward at San Onofre, says once you get behind those gates, there's no safety going on, and they're having trouble loading Coltec canisters in these holes in the ground by the beach. They have to try multiple times to get them in the holes, and in doing so, they're scratching the sides of those canisters, which is a trigger for corrosion, for cracking to start in these canisters. And the NRC, since once a crack starts, it can grow through the wall in 16 years. And each one of these cans is roughly a Chernobyl disaster. So this is serious stuff. The NRC is coming down September 10th to investigate, but, you know, usually they give them a pass, so we just kind of call it the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission around here. But
Coltec
is a real problem, and Edison's a real problem.
All right, well, we'll come back to all that, because I want to plow our way through at the front here to talk about this ongoing nonsense that nuclear power is some kind of antidote for global warming. It has occurred to me there are roughly 400 atomic reactors, commercial atomic reactors operating around the world. As best I can tell, there were about 450, and we had about 50 shut at in Japan, thanks to Fukushima. That's the one good thing that has come out of Fukushima. If you can expect any good things to come out of a nuclear holocaust, at least when Fukushima happened on March 11th, 2011, there were 54 reactors operating in Japan. And today, I think they've gotten, about three or four back online. Do any of you know how many reactors are back online in Japan?
Yeah, that's about right. At most five.
At most five. So the good news is that since 2012, it took them about a year to shut all the reactors in Japan, and they did. And then since then, the fascist leader of Japan, Shinzo Abe, a real cohort to Donald Trump, has been pushing as hard as he possibly can to get reactors back online in Japan. But I think, Kevin, you're right. It's only about five that have come back on. So at least Chernobyl has yielded us 7 years of 50 reactors shut down, which is, that's a big deal, actually, when you think of it. One thing that has occurred to me, and I want to run this by the three of you, is in this argument about whether or not nuclear power can help fight global warming, which is utterly insane. The industry has been arguing, and its mouthpieces have been arguing, that the nuclear power is emission-free, if you can believe that. But one thing they never talk about, and so therefore does not allegedly, which is false, put out greenhouse gases. One thing they never talk about is the actual fire and heat that's involved in operating nuclear power plants. I mean, I looked it up online, and the basic estimate that I've seen is that every nuclear plant operates at roughly 300 degrees centigrade. And so it seemed to me that was an understatement, but that's what I've read, and maybe you can correct it. But if you have roughly 400 atomic reactors operating roughly 24/7 at 300 degrees centigrade, these are big fires. How many BTUs, how much thermal energy, how much global warming is coming directly from the operation of these 400 commercial reactors? Has anybody actually done a calculation of how much actual heat is being added to the ecosphere just by the operation of these 400 reactors? Anybody want to take a crack at that?
I just remember from years ago a newspaper article in New York State looking at Indian Point, which is two full-size reactors operating still at this time. And they compared it to, they were comparing the heat, not the radioactivity, so the thermal heat. And they put it in terms of a Hiroshima bomb every hour into the Hudson River. So that was their comparison of heat. And then the pushback from the other side was, it's a big atmosphere. It's a big environment. It can absorb it. So that was the pushback from the other side.
Did they not argue against that calculation? I mean, are we actually getting 400 Hiroshima-equivalent blasts of heat every hour from the commercial reactors that are operating on this planet? And is that
It is a lot of heat. It's, I learned from Dr. Arjun Makajani years ago in one of his trainings that nuclear, like coal, is very inefficient, actually, at making electricity. And two-thirds of the heat generated by nuclear power plants is waste heat. It's not converted into electricity, so it has to go somewhere. So it either goes into the surface water as just direct waste heat pollution, and that's the case at Indian Point, no cooling towers. But even if you have cooling towers, what you're doing is you're evaporating surface water from the environment, turning it into steam, and releasing it onto the wind. So that's lost to the surface water. So these are major ecological impacts.
Well, the bottom line in terms of...
Canisters, Edison just told us that they're 200 to 300 degrees Celsius, each one of these canisters, when they load them on the... at least when they're initially loading them now on the facility. So you've got to multiply your number by the heat load coming out of all this stored canisters. There's over 2,400 canisters just in the United States, and I don't know what the heat load is to all of them, but the new ones they're loading are 200 to 300 degrees C.
Yeah, I've seen another factoid. I think it was in the Nuke Waste Con Game document that NRC put out a number of years ago, and it was kind of startling to me. I hadn't thought of it this way before, but at a typical nuclear power plant, so say Diablo Canyon or say Indian Point, each have two large reactors, San Onofre as well, now shut down. You're going to have, you know, dozens or scores of dry casks of highly radioactive irradiated nuclear fuel. And that, you know, just typical independent spent fuel storage installation that NRC was trying to describe would, with temperatures like that, and I've seen figures like 750 degrees Fahrenheit in the heart of a dry cask, and you've got the ventilation going on to the atmospheric, you know, environmental air. And they said that out to a radius of a kilometer, you're increasing the atmospheric temperature 1 degree Celsius. So I was like, right, that's a lot of heat.
Well, I would write, and I'm going to put this on the table if any of you want to co-author with me, I'd like to write a piece that takes an assessment of just the gross heat that's injected into our ecosphere by these nuclear power plants. I mean, these clowns are out there saying, there's no CO2 or greenhouse gases emitted by nuclear power plants, which is a lie, of course. Therefore, nuclear power fights global warming. But they never talk about the actual heat. I mean, they are taking inert uranium. Uranium in the ground does not emit heat. Am I correct?
Well, there's a very slow motion radioactive decay of natural uranium. So, you know, there's going to be some heat released when a uranium-238 or even a uranium-235 atom disintegrates in nature, but it's very slow motion. I mean, the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. That's how slow motion we're talking for radioactive decay. So, yeah, there's a heat release, but it's not like nuclear plants, which accelerates it astronomically and concentrates it in, you know, certain places at the surface of the Earth.
Yeah, I don't know, Kevin, that there's much U-235 in nature, maybe tiny, tiny, tiny bits, but that... Isn't that part of the enrichment process, or do I have it?
Yeah, it's 0.7% of natural uranium, but even my point about uranium-238, which is the other 99.3% pretty much, it does decay in nature very slowly. Mm-hmm. The Earth has only seen one radioactive decay, one half-life of uranium-238 in its entire existence. So it is letting go of heat in nature deep down in the Earth's crust, in many cases, and incredibly slowly. At a nuclear power plant with the 235 enriched, you're putting a lot out all at the same time in concentrated places.
So I would like to see, and Donna raised the issue of the casks themselves being hot, which hadn't occurred to me, especially, I mean, that's really, really hot. Those casks are 200 to 300 degrees centigrade, Donna?
That's what Southern California Edison said. The NRC has recently allowed double the heat load in each canister. They used to require more cooling of the fuel, and they used to use not-so-hot fuel to start with. And now they're allowing fuel that's over twice as thermally hot and over twice as radioactive, and putting more fuel assemblies in each can. So they've got it so hot they've made it impossible to put the fuel back into the pool. And that's when they have a problem with a canister, Edison admitted, Tom Palmisano, he admitted in March that, you know, they're too hot to load back into the pool. And they're required by their license to be able to do that. And he admitted that they can't do that. He's trying to walk it back, but he doesn't have any, you know, evidence. You know, and that's only one of the problems in trying to unload those canisters. So there's the Nuclear
Right.
Regulatory Commission is providing cover. They are not doing their job. They're providing cover for the nuclear industry and, you know, approving crazy things. And I see our Congress trusting the NRC to do their job. That myth needs to be busted with our Congress so they know what's going on.
And when you talk about the heat from these canisters, you then raise the issue of trying to put high-level nuclear waste, which of course would be in canisters, in a place like like Yucca Mountain, which is a closed environment. And I, early on, many years ago, probably 20 years ago, I saw a major study that predicted that if, in fact, what they want to do at Yucca Mountain, the heat, the cumulative heat from the stored nuclear waste would cause a major explosion, just blow the place up. And did you, any of you see that?
Well, there was a study about what if there were critical masses that formed once the containers started leaking at Yucca, and, you know, plutonium-239 came together in a big way. And, yeah, there was even an indication that a low-level nuclear explosion could occur. Some Los Alamos scientists admitted that. But how would it leak out? And that gets more to the point of the thermal heat in the waste, and that is that the thermal heat in the waste is very significant for centuries into the future. There's a lot of water in the underground at Yucca, and there's very corrosive rock chemistry, and it's the perfect storm for corroding the waste burial containers, and then, sure enough, you could have critical masses form and, you know, that low-level nuclear explosion that was described.
Right, and even without a critical mass forming, you do have perched water at the top inside Yucca Mountain. And if there's sufficient thermal heat, let alone thermonuclear, just thermal heat accumulated to high enough levels, that water could be boiled, could break through, fall down on the casks, and create a steam explosion. I mean, Jesus, you know, these guys are just crazy. So I would like to see, and I'd like to put this out to you three, Linda, Donna and Kevin, that we take an assessment, find a way to assess the actual thermal heat that's added to our ecosphere by these 400 hourly Hiroshimas, and plus the additional cumulative heat produced by the storage, the gas. I mean, I'll bet it's a huge number. Then you have to add in, of course, how much thermal heat was added to the atmosphere by the four explosions of Fukushima and the one at Chernobyl, not to mention what happened at Three Mile Island, Fermi, and all the other little mishaps that have been going on.
That's a great idea, Harvey. I wanted to chime in here. This is Linda. We had an NRC meeting here this week. And as I said, they gave a glowing report about the performance of Diablo Canyon over the past year, which is not relevant to this. But I want to tell you that what I learned a few things there. Number one, I learned that, you know, we have so many plants decommissioning right now. And I was speaking to one of the NRC reps who was there, and he told me that, and what we have is a situation where there is no, you know, with an operating nuclear plant, you have a list of regulations and performance standards and all sorts of safety rules, et cetera, et cetera. But nuclear plants are supposed to adhere to those rules. But in their great wisdom and foresight, they never wrote any regulations for decommissioning nuclear power plants. So the way they are processing decommissioning right now is through what they're doing at San Onofre, for instance, right now, is that They're using the rules and regulations for operating nuclear plants, but asking for exemptions from those rules and regulations and applying those exemptions to the decommissioning. And was a letter written by several senators. I think it was Markey, Sanders. Senator Harris was one, and Gillibrand, I think, about...
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, that they discovered this, that there's no, you know, there's no framework for decommissioning. And it's kind of sort of a Wild West scenario that they're going through with trying to decommission these very, very complicated nuclear plants. And so the senator said, wait, what? You don't have any regulations about this, you who are responsible for it? And so apparently that is going to be on the table for us to get some kind of, you know, standards, I guess is what you'd call it.
All right, so let's get this straight, Linda. You're saying that the first nuclear power commercial reactor opened at Shippingport, Pennsylvania in 1957. And here we are 61 years later, and they never had any regulations or guidelines on how they're going to decommission these reactors.
That's right.
That's exciting.
And they were licensed for 40 years, and they never thought about that. And I said, well, why, to this guy from the NRC, why didn't you think about that? And he said, well, you know, 9/11 came along, and we had to just focus all of our energy on, safety and security. And then Fukushima came along, and we had to focus all of our effort on that. And we just haven't had the resources to focus on decommissioning, orderly decommissioning of nuclear power plants.
Well, of course, 9/11 only came 44 years after Shippingport, after it opened, but Shippingport was decommissioned. And where is the comic book that came out of the decommissioning of Shippingport? Donna Gilmore, you've been following the decommissioning of San Onofre pretty closely. What can you tell us about it?
Well, be careful what you ask for. I mean, what they're doing is they're allowing the spent fuel pools, once they're empty, to be destroyed with knowledge that they have no other way to unload canisters. The NRC assumes nothing can go wrong once it's in dry storage. And working with the Sierra Club, we submitted comments in 2016 with a long list of their own evidence, the NRC's own evidence of why that's a false assumption. I asked Tom Palmisano the other day, I said, why are you going to destroy the pools? You have no way to deal with cracking canisters if you do that. Your license requires that if you have a 75% through wall crack, you have to take the canister out of service. How are you going to do that? And you know what his answer was to me? I'll have to get back to you on that, Donna.
Oh, God. What is the point? I mean, it costs money to destroy these things. Why would they spend the money to destroy
these? It's a huge overhead. Edison was in a trade magazine bragging about how much overhead costs they're going to save by getting rid of the pools. So use overhead costs for them. That's all they care about.
Well, here, I got an idea. One of the motivations
is to, free up these sites for unrestricted use. So we experienced completed so-called decommissioning in Michigan at Big Rock Point that the NRC blessed and said, okay, go ahead, you can use the land for whatever you want now. You could build a state park there. You could build mansions on the Golden Coast of Lake Michigan. The one problem, of course, is that the high-level radioactive waste gases are still there. But what's also still there is significant contamination, and that's a part of what Linda was talking about, the kind of regulation-free zone of decommissioning. NRC only requires that these companies, essentially they let the companies make the decisions and they just say, okay. And the decisions include how deep to go down in your cleanup. And Deb Katz at Citizens Awareness Network in the Northeast, speaking of the Connecticut Yankee decommissioning, said that, yeah, they went down a few feet, but the contamination extended hundreds of feet down. They had a leaking pool for many years at Connecticut Yankee, leaking into soil and groundwater. Same thing up at Big Rock Point. Those were mostly reactor releases, as far as we know, at Big Rock Point. But they have significant contamination. They did have a big spill in a building one time, and they didn't clean it up. They just let it blow into the soil, into the groundwater, and into Lake Michigan. And one place they didn't clean up at all was the sediments of Lake Michigan, and they'd been discharging for 35 years of operations down a discharge canal into Lake Michigan. They didn't even check to see how bad the contamination levels were in the sediments. That's what they call a completed decommissioning at Big Rock Point, Michigan.
Well, I have a proposal here. I want to propose that we leave the pool, spent fuel pools at every nuclear plant, and that each spent fuel pool be turned into an exclusive swimming facility for all the executives who built these nuclear plants, and that they'd be required to swim at least once a month in these pools just to demonstrate how safe they are. Do you think that would go over big at San Onofre, Donna? What do you think?
Actually, we had somebody fall in the pools. Nobody knows what happened to him. All of a sudden, nobody's heard from him.
Yeah, right. And their bones disappear.
I'm curious.
And all that
he
stuff.
Did. He was leaning over to pick up something, and he fell in.
Oh, somebody actually did fall in?
Yes. Hey, you know, at San Onofre, the unbelievable happens here pretty much all the time. So the new thing is their Edison's plan is to hide the radiation leaks. It's like what Kevin is talking about, where they didn't tell you about all the releases. They actually submitted, they have an application, AREVA's application is in there to the NRC, so they no longer have to measure the peak radiation coming out of the overpack air vent. This is where, when these canisters start leaking, that's where it's going to go. So basically, they're going to hide the leaks. They are Calvert Cliffs, they have the oldest, one of some of the oldest thin wall canisters, they're 25 years. They already have NRC approval to not have to report radiation levels coming out of the air vents of the canister overpacks. So that's their real plan, is to hide the leaks.
So do you think that the nuclear industry has really been planted here by space aliens who want to wipe out the human race? Is that
yes.
a possibility?
Has to be.
There's a definitive yes. Let's talk. I want to do a little overview thing here. There are a number of reactors that are shutting down, so this decommissioning issue becomes ever more instant and really with us, contemporary. I know Oyster Creek in New Jersey is scheduled to shut down. Plymouth in Massachusetts. What's the timetable on these, Kevin? We have sort of a queue of reactors shutting down. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, Oyster Creek, New Jersey is scheduled to shut down in 2 to 3 weeks from now. It's the oldest operating reactor in the United States. Wow. It's 49 years old. It's a Fukushima Daiichi twin, a General Electric boiling water reactor of the Mark I design. So it can't shut down soon enough, of course. And
Are the owners trying to backpedal? Is there any indication they're going to try and are the owners trying to backpedal? Is there any indication they're going to try and avoid shutting down?
No, it's pretty clear that they're going to shut down. And it's pretty clear, too, that Pilgrim near Boston is going to shut down by mid-2019, the latest. And significantly, another company is going to take over at both of those sites, as well as at Palisades in Michigan in 2022, once it shuts down, supposedly. And that is Holtec International. And as we were talking about the mafia and the nuclear industry, it occurred to me that something, I think the Holtecs are used at Diablo too, right, Linda?
Yes, they are.
So connecting San Onofre, Diablo, and Chernobyl is this company called Holtec, and they are crooks, and they are about to enter into the decommissioning business, and their first plant is going to be Oyster Creek. And at the very same time, they're trying to open this mega dump in New Mexico. They call it centralized interim storage. And, I say they're crooks. The CEO and president, Chris Singh, actually tried to bribe a whistleblower into silence a couple decades ago, and the offer was rejected, about how bad these containers are that they use. And then I learned more recently that down at TVA's Browns Ferry in Alabama that Holtec was engaged in bribery to secure contracts, but the only one who seemed to really get into trouble was the person who took the bribe. Holtec was slapped on the wrist with a 60-day, a two-month suspension of its business activities at TVA, and that was it. And then they carried on as if nothing happened.
Wow.
God almighty. What other reactors are in line to shut down in the near term?
Well, besides Oyster Creek and Pilgrim, those are the nearest two. And then Palisades, I mentioned 2022. You've got others like Indian Point Units 2 and 3. Those are 2020 and 2021 shutdown dates. And there are others, too, that I'm blanking on. But, of course, Linda can speak of Diablo Canyon's scheduled shutdown.
Of course, we did have we had Fitzpatrick and the other three in upstate New York in various stages of shutdown before Andrew Cuomo sailed in and offered a $7.6 billion bailout. He debated Cynthia Nixon last night. I don't think it came up in their debate, unfortunately. I read an account of it that, we could say there were other reactors in line to be shutting down sooner rather than later. We do have 2024 and 2025 as the shutdown dates for Diablo Canyon. Linda Seeley in San Luis Obispo, is there any indication that we can get those shut down earlier?
Well, I want to mention to you that at the NRC meeting the other night, that I did bring up the issue of the Unit 1 reactor vessel that in 2003 was declared by the NRC itself to be the third most embrittled reactor vessel in the whole fleet of reactors, which at that time was 104. The thing that's, and what they, how they figure this out, how brittle they are, it's not, it's a scientific process. And they do it by, when they manufacture a reactor vessel, they put these things called coupons in them. Funny name. But what a coupon is a piece of metal that's fabricated out of exactly the same substance as the metal welds inside of the reactor vessel. And they place, I don't know, a dozen or so of these inside of the vessel when they manufacture it. And then after it's working for a certain amount of time, they take a coupon out and they test it to see if it's, if that has become embrittled. And indeed, it had at Diablo Canyon. Unfortunately, the last time they removed a coupon from the reactor vessel was in 2003. They're supposed to get them tested every 10 years. When it came up for retesting in 2013, the PG&E applied for a license exemption or a license amendment to exempt them from having to do that test. They applied for and got permission to do robotic testing inside, which is not the same as destructive testing of a coupon. So they got that exemption, and now they do not have to do any more testing of the coupons till that reactor shuts down. So at the NRC the other night, I requested from the NRC that they order PG&E to do a coupon test to test and see how embrittled that reactor vessel is. It costs about $200,000, I guess, to do that test. It's pretty expensive, but I bet they can afford it. But it costs, I can't remember, $450 million or something like that to replace a reactor vessel. It's super duper expensive. So they don't want to have to replace that, and they just want to get along till the thing closes down. But the NRC's response to me was, they have met the minimum requirements for safety on this reactor vessel, and so we don't have any authority to do it, to, you know, order them to do it. And I, so I said, well, why don't you have the authority? I thought you were the regulator. And they said, well, you know, they meet these requirements, these minimum requirements. It seems insane to me, frankly, that if we already knew 15 years ago it was the third most embrittled reactor, and it becomes more embrittled the more it's used, wouldn't you think that the NRC and PG&E would want to know how embrittled it is? Because we have, like, a lot of people in California who would be very, very, and not to mention animals, plants, and other living things, that would not do very well if that reactor vessel cracked open during a cold shutdown.
Well, I'm reminded that this dates back all the way to 1991. The Yankee Row reactor, it was one of the very, very earliest reactors. At the time, it was the oldest reactor in the United States. And it was hit by lightning and shut down. And the anti-nuclear forces in western Massachusetts and southern Vermont got together, and they forced a hearing in the Congress at which the new NRC chairman, Ivan Selin, was summoned. And there was a congressman named Kesemoyer, something like that, Kestenmeyer, I think. And I was sitting there at the table next to Ivan Selin, and we challenged Selin to not allow Yankee Row to reopen until they had tested for embrittlement. And because theoretically, at least, it was very clear that the reactor was severely embrittled. And it had been operating since the late 50s, early 60s. This was in 91. And the congressman told Selin, basically, who was, you know, facing confirmation, not to reopen Yankee Row until the basic tests for embrittlement had been done. In order to do it at the time, they had to send in a robot to which had not really been designed to scoop out a piece of the core. And the owners of Yankee Row finally said, well, we can't do that, and they shut Yankee Row. And here we are all these years later, and 27 years later, and they can't test the core at Diablo. This is an important precedent that we should talk about at Diablo. I mean, the next time they do a fuel load, maybe we should file some kind of legal action.
Yeah, they're due for an outage in 2019 on that unit. And they could pull a coupon at that time if they would be ordered to do so, or if they would do it voluntarily.
Yeah, right. Fat chance. Well, we will have a new governor who doesn't have any legal clout, but maybe Gavin Newsom could be persuaded to put some pressure on PG&E, which is going to be under severe attack. I mean, PG&E may be in bankruptcy by that time. Isn't that right, Linda?
Oh, yeah. It could be. I mean, they're being sued for, I think, $13 or $14 billion for the fires in Northern California.
Right. So
because of
poor
care of the transmission lines, I think.
Well, maybe we Californians, Donna, Linda and I, and Kevin, you at the belly of the beast there in D.C., might want to anticipate some kind of legal filing when they shut to force some kind of inspection of the embrittlement of the core. That might be, Mike, I don't know, you know, by then Trump's lunatics will have taken over the judiciary, but it would be probably worth exploring. That would be a key moment.
Yeah, my coworker Paul Gunter has been calling loudly for nuclear autopsies, as he calls them, the examination of systems, structures, and components like embrittled reactor pressure vessels to try to apply those lessons learned from a place like Diablo Canyon to other operating pressurized water reactors. And I just wanted to add that Palisades, Michigan, is the worst embrittled in the entire country. Point Beach, Wisconsin, is number two, just across Lake Michigan. And then one of the units at Indian Point is in the top five list for bad as well. And so is one of the Beaver Valley units near Pittsburgh. So
how can they evaluate
pressure vessel risks out there?
But shy of sending a scuba diver in there, I mean, how do they know? How can they compare embrittlement? How do they measure it?
They've long known that certain reactor pressure vessels had a bad metallurgical mix that made them very susceptible to neutron embrittlement because of the impurities, the real high levels of certain metals like nickel is one of them. So what the NRC has done time and time again for decades, and you spoke, Harvey, about the early 90s, but it went back even a decade or more than that when they started worrying about embrittlement. There was a whistleblower at NRC named Faz Dikas, who even wrote op-eds to the New York Times as to how serious this was. And we really took it as far as we could at Palisades. Just a few years ago, we tried to get hearings before an Atomic Safety and Licensing Board as Palisades sought yet another regulatory rollback. And we got some traction, not on the scenario that Linda described of a sudden shutdown with the emergency core cooling system. That would be like a hot glass under cold water, only 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch kind of scenario for reactor pressure vessel rupture through wall. But there's another one to worry about, too, and that is if the reactor pressure vessel gets too hot. So they've kind of pencil-whipped away the cold glass under cold water. It's not legitimate. It's not science, but they've said, we've covered that. We've thought about it. What they've not thought about at all is if the reactor pressure vessel gets too hot and tears apart because of the excessive heat in a similar fashion during operations. That's where we got some traction at Palisades, and like always happens when you're about to get a hearing before a licensing board, the company appealed to the NRC commissioners. They reached into the process and overruled the licensing board, and they said there will be no hearing on these matters. And, we've got some giant nuclear experiments with very age-degraded reactors going on in this country.
It's unbelievable a company could go to a commission and stop a hearing. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. I'm curious, Donna, in the decommissioning of San Onofre, was anything learned about embrittlement? Was that looked at all?
Not that I'm aware of. In terms of the reactor vessel head, no, I'm not aware of any looking at anything. So, I mean, the NRC, I mean, they know that there's defective metals that and manufacturing that was done by Areva. And they won't even look at those in this country where that metal was used. So, I mean, we have a totally captured Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They're just going to do whatever the industry wants. I mean, the reason I got involved in nuclear issues is because the NRC isn't doing their job. So it's actually up to us to find a way to do their job or to out them to the people that have power and influence in this country so that this can be fixed and we can stop this craziness. It's going to be too late if we aren't successful soon, I'm afraid. I mean, and with these Chernobyl cans I just looked up Oyster Creek. They're already 16 years old at Oyster Creek, and the Cobourg nuclear plant has a comparable container. It didn't have nuclear waste in it. But it leaked in 17 years. And so now, you know, we've got canisters that are just getting to the age where they can have through wall cracks. And a new wrinkle is if water gets inside through a crack, the fuel inside will go critical. I don't know how bad the criticality will be, but that's another piece of information most people don't know. So.
Oh, God. Kevin, that hearing that was canceled, did anyone think to maybe hold it anyway without the NRC?
Well, that's kind of what we did was, you know, in the official proceeding, we created quite a paper trail. And Arne Gunderson was our expert witness. And Terry Lodge was our attorney. Michael Keegan was our researcher. And there's a website, Epion Nuclear. It's in October of 2014, because that's when the proceeding began, where we documented the embrittlement issue as best we could, as comprehensively as we could. And some of the earliest documents in that timeline go back to the 1940s, if you can believe it. And we learned some incredible things. Keegan and Arnie, doing the research, found that the reason the Palisades, a part of the reason the Palisades was so bad, besides the metallurgical impurities, was the fact that it was the first time that they allowed one of these reactors to be built without what's called a thermal shield. The thermal shield would have been between the fuel and the reactor pressure vessel and would have absorbed some of that neutron flow. And they just took it out to maximize electricity production and profit making. And one of the things they said in there was, and this was, I believe, the future NRC chairman during the Three Mile Island meltdown, who was called the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards chairman at the time in the late 60s, early 70s at Palisades. He said, you know, if it gets too embrittled, they can just anneal it, which means superheat it. And that's kind of one of those empty promises that has been floated at Palisades more times than I can count. If it gets too bad, we'll anneal it. And they've not done that in a half century. And they first violated embrittlement at Palisades in 1981, 10 years into operations. So we do have a paper trail, and others are welcome to borrow from it as much as you want to go after Diablo.
We're getting near the end here. Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, how do people get a hold of you?
Our website is www.beyondnuclear.org.
And Linda Seeley at Diablo Canyon?
www.mothersforpeace.org.
And Donna Gilmore at San Onofre?
San Onofre Safety.org. San Onofre is spelled SANONOFRE, safe, and then safety.org. And we've got news about a whistleblower that just came out, so you can watch the whistleblower at San Onofre to see how bad this whole tech company is in Edison. So that's fairly fresh news there.
So we got two assignments coming out of this show. I am going to start to do the research on an article that would make an assessment, and I'm sure it's been done, of the gross heat that comes from the simultaneous operation of about 400 hourly Hiroshimas. It must be gargantuan, and this whole nonsense of nuclear power as an antidote to global warming, completely insane. And maybe we can also start talking about a legal intervention when Diablo Canyon gets refueled to force them to look at the embrittlement with this coupon, or however, whatever other technology, using as precedent the 1991 shutdown of Yankee Row, which was never reopened after it was challenged, and they could not actually do an assessment of the level of embrittlement in there. So let's hope that certainly at Diablo Canyon we get an angle. We will have a new governor, and Jerry Brown turning into an incredible disappointment in his last few years. Hopefully fresh blood with Gavin Newsom, who is certainly familiar with the Diablo issue. This should be a small ask, don't you think, my fellow Californians? And Kevin, if you can round up some D.C.-based legal help on this, maybe we can make an issue of this. Certainly in California, it would be of public interest, and maybe we can find a judge who'll give us a hearing on it.
It's interesting to me. We've kind of bookended a major era of NRC regulatory capture, as Donna put it. After Yankee Row, the decision was made that would never happen again. A reactor would never be shut down like that. And so the license extension process became a rubber stamp process ever since. Mm-hmm. But then the agreement was made to not seek the license extension at Diablo Canyon. And that was kind of the end of that rubber stamp era. So in 2011, the Associated Press talked about this regulatory capture at NRC. This was just after Fukushima began. And they used the reactor pressure vessel embrittlement regulatory rollback as its top example of that regulatory capture.
Yeah, and also, Linda, the economic pressures at Diablo, which, you know, it's not really making money down there, and with PG&E under attack.
The shutdown has absolutely nothing to do with safety or embrittlement, anything like that. The shutdown is only driven by the economics of it, because it would be too expensive. They need to do a bunch of repairs, including a stator, which costs, I think, $320 million. No, I'm sorry, that's wrong. It's $156 million to replace a stator. And they don't want to have to do that. They don't want to have to put all that money into Diablo Canyon because it's because it doesn't make sense economically. That's all.
Well, let's and Donnie, you'll of course be involved. Let's see if we can ramp up the pressure, and when they shut for refueling, let's see if we can stop them from firing back up. That'll be our next magic moment, and we can certainly make issue of the casks of the waste storage there. I think we're near the end. You guys are just great. You know, let's get this show out there, and let's do this and get these reactors shut before they shut us all. Thank you for the crew in New York. This has been another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We'll see you next week in Solartopia.
What we conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost. So we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.